and welcome to Food Allergy and Your Kiddo. I am your host, Dr. Alice Hoyt. Excited, very excited to be joined today by Dr. Edwin Kim. Some of you may know him as the food allergist who was really, really pioneering SLIT. And when I talk about SLIT, sublingual immunotherapy, evidence-based approach. Y'all know if you're coming to this podcast, to this show, you're looking for family-focused, evidence-based information. And that is what we're providing here today. So Dr. Kim, thank you so much for coming onto the show.
Yeah, happy to be here.
Awesome. So the first question I really want to ask, and what our listeners are probably wondering, is really, how did you find yourself researching food allergy? Tell us about your journey.
Yeah, I mean, I think it started in the home growing up. I didn't realize it at the time, but we had lots of allergy in the house, whether it's seasonal allergies, food allergy, eczema, asthma. We had a lot of that floating between my parents, my brother, and myself. And I think that probably planted the seeds that I didn't realize. Fast forward all the way into college, and then I was starting to head down the med school route, and immunology in particular really stood out to me. The idea that your immune system is perfectly tuned to be able to fight off any possible infection that could be out there. And so that was fascinating to me. But then as I started to learn about allergy and autoimmune disease and starting to realize, wait, the immune system is not perfect. And there are ways that it can overreact in the case of allergy or even attack itself in autoimmunity really stood out. So, I got into our field really initially focused more on the actual basic science immunology side. But then just by pure chance, I happened to do a rotation at Duke University Medical Center where Dr. Wesley Burks was the allergy program director as well as the chief of allergy and one of the pioneers of the food allergy research that we've been doing. And so I was fortunate enough to work with him for a month, hear him talk, and to just understand sort of the scope of the food allergy problem. And again, this idea of how the immune system, which is supposed to be so perfect, is not so perfect when it comes to food allergy, really, really rung true to me. And so I ended up staying on and training under him, getting exposure to these different treatments, oral immunotherapy, and then the sublingual. And then fast forward to this is where I am.
That's amazing. And for our moms and dads listening and grandparents who are listening to the podcast, I know that whenever you're looking for good articles, good journal articles, sometimes you're wondering, well, how do I know it's a good article? If the name Wes Burks is on the article, it's a good article.
There's your
litmus test. Done.
That's exactly right.
So Dr. Kim, awesome that you've been able to train under him and work with him and collaborate with him. And also, I mean, just that whole area is just so filled with amazing food allergy focused docs. So that's awesome. And I'm not surprised that such cool research is coming out of y'all's labs and has been for decades at this point. But what I really want to talk about today is your amazing paper, Desensitization and Remission After Peanut Sublingual Immunotherapy in 1 to 4 year old peanut allergic children, a randomized placebo controlled trial. So that's a mouthful.
Yes.
But every single word in there is so critical. You have some real rock stars on this paper too. Drew Bird, Corinne Keat, Wes Burks. I mean, it's the real deal, y'all. So so let's talk through just breaking down the title. Because also the term remission has started really floating around on the interwebs. And the title is Desensitization and Remission After Peanut SLIT. So let's first talk about that. How did you guys define desensitization and how did you define remission?
Yeah, so that's probably the most important question here. And I think as a field, we've been trying to figure this out. What are the proper definitions for these? And I think where our field has really come back to now with the word desensitization, at least, is the idea that while you're actively being treated, and that could be whether it's going to be oral, sublingual, or other treatments that are out there, that we are able to make someone either non-reactive or less reactive. So increase that amount of food that it takes to actually have an outward allergic reaction. Now, again, depending on sort of what study you see, that threshold, like you'll see differences. Some of them might just say the maximum that we gave during that food challenge and nothing happened. Others will just say above a certain amount that we think would be the likely exposure you would have, you know, in cross-contamination or something else like that. So I do think that it's important for us as allergists and patients and families, all of us, to be careful to understand when that word is being used, what they're actually referring to. For this particular study, what we try to do is in assessing whether the actual treatment was working, we gave kids up to 4,443 milligrams. What in the world does that mean? We estimate that to be pretty close to about a serving size of peanut for these kids. And it's the equivalent of probably about 15 peanuts. And so we wanted to make sure, can the kids eat that much peanut with no sort of symptoms at all? Now, again, going back to that point of like, how much does it take to get sick? What we have seen, we don't have great data on this, but what we've seen is most kids, if they're going to get sick from eating a little bit of peanut cross-contamination, it takes only about a third to one peanut. So about 100 to 300 milligrams. So in this case, we pushed the envelope. We wanted to make sure, you know, way over 4,000 plus milligrams that nothing would happen at all. And so that's how we define desensitization here. Now, the next part, though,
which is pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's really cool. It's really cool. Just, and especially, I mean, I'm jumping the gun here, but the idea that our treatment is only giving 4 milligrams, this tiny little amount of peanut every day, and then we're getting 1,000 times that in benefit, like over 4,000 milligrams, which is just, it's kind of mind boggling in a good way.
Yeah, we'll talk about the protocol in a minute, because I know our listeners are wondering, wait, how do they go from four and then 100 and then 4,000? Like, what?
Yep. Yep. And then jumping to that remission. And so this is another problem we've had in our field of course, the gold standard, the goal we're looking for is we want to cure the kids. We want the kids to be able to eat whatever they want, whenever they want. We're trying to get there. We're not there yet. Unfortunately, we're probably not close. But in the process of getting there, one of the things that I think we're all thinking about is, how do we even know? Like, when we think about what we're eating on an everyday basis, we don't say, oh, I haven't had shrimp today. Like, it's been a couple of weeks. I need to go eat it. Like, when you're not allergic, you just eat it whenever you want to and whatever you want to do. But in a research study, you kind of can't do it that way. And so we've been trying to figure out in a research study, how can we fairly confidently say, okay, you're not reactive and that's okay. And so the earliest kind of ways we tried to do this was we would treat someone, show that they were not reactive, desensitized, and then take the treatment away for a couple of weeks, maybe up to a month, and then come back and try that again. And if you were, again, were not reactive, that looked pretty good. But then you could easily say, well, how do we know, like a month and a day or 2 months, then suddenly you're allergic again. So then we started pushing it out a little further. And so, so we have found that a group of kids, especially when they start young, seem to be able to get to this point where there's some lasting change in the immune system. Again, we're nervous to say permanent, but at least some lasting change that even a few months later, they're still not reactive. And so the IMPACT study, which was published last year, looked at the oral immunotherapy, the OIT for peanut, and found that it wasn't a large number, but about a fifth of those patients, 20% of them, even 6 months after stopping the peanuts, still stayed not reactive at all. And so, for lack of a better term, we decided that that might be the best way to describe that would be remission. So that disease is there, but it's sort of in hiding. It's not doing anything. And could they eventually have a relapse where those symptoms come back? Possibly. We hope not, but possibly. And so that's kind of where the remission word has started to pop into our food allergy world. And so for our particular treatment, this was planned. This study started probably 6-7 years ago. So we didn't know the IMPACT results. We had arbitrarily decided 3 months seemed like a really long time. And so in our minds, we thought, well, again, this seems pretty good. And it seems to suggest that the immune system has some lasting benefit. So that's how we've used that word here.
This is Alexis from the Hoyt Institute of Food Allergy. Did you know that the Institute is the official sponsor of the Food Allergy and Your Kiddo podcast? And did you also know that you are now able to connect with Dr. Hoyt directly? That's right. We are now offering food allergy office hours for parents. These one-on-one virtual sessions are available for parents all across the country. It's an educational session, not an office visit, where you can ask all of your food allergy questions and finally get answers. It's as comfortable as having a cup of coffee with your bestie. Simply click the link in the show notes to schedule and mention this ad. We are so, so excited to connect with parents across the globe with this new service. Okay, now back to Pam and Dr. Hoyt.
Well, also because if you're listening, you're probably thinking, well, if it worked, why would you stop it?
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Like if you get to where a kiddo is desensitized, why would you stop it? And we stop it because in the world of oral immunotherapy, participating in oral immunotherapy is a big commitment, specifically of time, and having a kiddo avoid strenuous activities during what's called their safety window, meaning an hour before, 2 hours after their dose. They really need to not participate in anything that's going to raise their heart rate, raise their body temperature, because those things can lower the threshold to have an allergic reaction. So undergoing oral immunotherapy is a big commitment. And so when you can get to a sense of normalcy and start to step away of that gazelle intensity, essentially, mm-hmm. for dosing, and you do have a negative ingestion challenge after being on oral immunotherapy, it is really an art at this time to figure out, okay, how much do they need to keep in the diet?
That's right.
Do they still need a safety window? Do they need to carry epi? Usually we err on the side of yes for that. Mm-hmm. At least for the time being. And what's so amazing about SLIT, as we'll talk about, is that safety window is much looser. And that is because of the low side effect risk. Mm-hmm. But I'm getting ahead of myself. I do want to talk about the protocol that you guys use. And how did you, can you just sort of talk us through what it would look like for a family to come in and participate? Of course, they were blinded. You guys were blinded. So you didn't know if they were getting the actual peanut slit or a placebo slit. But talk us through what that looked like. How many up doses? Were they up dosing at home? All of those things.
Yeah. So if it's okay, I'm going to take a few seconds just to kind of explain how we got to where we got to.
And absolutely.
So, I mentioned back with my training when I first got involved with SLIT, and at the exact same time, we were directly studying oral immunotherapy, OIT. Actually, one of my colleagues was more focused on the OIT, and then I happened to be involved with the SLIT. And so we were watching with OIT that on the one hand works really good, really strong desensitization. But at the same time, we saw a lot of the side effects that came with it. The, the allergic reactions, some of the taste aversions, some of these cofactors that you mentioned about exercise. And so, seeing that with our SLIT, we started very conservatively as well. So we had a long buildup period, 6-7 months coming in every 2 weeks, similar to OIT. But the nice thing with our studies is over that first cohort that we studied for 5 years, we looked at the safety data and my goodness, it was great. We weren't having a lot of side effects. We weren't having anaphylaxis. We were having a decent amount of this mouth itch that is very common with SLIT. And when we checked out the timing of this, what we realized was if it's going to happen, it happens really short in time, like within a few minutes, maybe last 10, 15 minutes, and then it's done. But we weren't seeing people 1 hour out, 2 hours out, 3 hours out having any such of side effects. And so we were able to shrink down the observation time all the way down to 30 minutes and feel very confident with that. And then as we continue to look at it, we just...
Was there any pre-observation time? Was there any time they needed to be not doing activities prior to their dose?
So that's the other aspect as well. So we were paying attention to this because we had seen it with OIT. But for this, thinking that the dose was so small, that this first study, we actually looked at only 2 milligrams compared to OIT, where they're using anywhere from 300 to 4,000. So we were paying attention, but we didn't directly say avoid this or avoid that. It was more sort of the idea of, well, with OIT, we've seen this. So if you notice anything, let us know. And we did not. Now, again, it's not a perfect way to study this, but we didn't see those same problems. But again, when we went back and looked at how often are people having anaphylaxis, wheezing, more serious side effects, and we just didn't see it. And so the protocol that we use for this study that you're talking about, what we incorporated there were going to be a lot of home updosing. Because we just hadn't seen the problems with it. And so what this current protocol looks like, which we hope
pretty amazing.
We hope it's a pretty, yeah, we hope this is a friendly Yeah.
Right.
Our hope is that this will be sort of a good sort of in the middle type of thing. So the first dose, of course, would be in the clinic, just to absolutely make sure that we're all on the same page, show them how to show the patients, the families, how to do the medicine. And then the idea would be to take the bottle home, which is a bottle filled with the slit liquid and a pumper. And then they're given specific instructions on how many pumps to do, and each time should be once a day. And so the idea would be that they go home, do the single pump once a day for a week, and then they're given instructions to double it up to two, and a week later to four, and then to eight. And then they come back into the clinic 1 month later, and then we give them the next strength of bottle, and then they follow that same pattern. So at home, they do the increases once a week, and then come back in a month later. And so there's four direct in-clinic monthly visits. So rather than the 10, 11, 12 that you might see with an OIT protocol, and then they're a month apart as opposed to every 2 weeks, it's still visits to the clinic, which could be difficult for folks. But what we are learning is that it's fairly flexible. And so a little bit longer on a dose is never going to hurt anyone. And so we're hoping that this can sort of be that happy medium between like not being so burdensome of too many visits to the office, but enough that they have a lot of FaceTime with us, because I do think that it's so important that we have that opportunity to talk through sort of what are the risks? How would you treat a reaction? You know, is this a cure? Is this not a cure? You know, some of these things just to make sure that the families feel confident in kind of what they're doing and what the benefits are and aren't, because we don't want folks going out there thinking that this is going to be a cure-all either. And so I do think that those touch points really help a lot.
1,000,000%. I think the more that we as allergists can directly engage with our patients and answer their questions, hence this podcast, the better, so that they don't have to go onto social media to try to find those answers. And when you're going through something like sublingual immunotherapy or oral immunotherapy, or even sometimes a series of ingestion challenges, you are getting that FaceTime with your doctor that isn't necessarily what the visit is directly about, but is so important. Yes. It's such important, critical time, I find, to help not just grow a family's depth of knowledge regarding their child's allergic disorder, but also ease that anxiety that absolutely comes along with kiddos who have food allergies. So I just, as my patients know, I love to sit and talk with them and make sure that they know that they can come to me with questions. They can still look, of course, online, but please, by all means, ask me your questions. And so that's so great. And I love that you recognize that it is good time for you guys to connect, but then you're also recognizing the burden that OIT can be on families and coming in for the multiple appointments and missing work and missing school and all of the things. So that's amazing. That's amazing.
If it's okay, can I add one more piece in here?
You can add. Yes.
Well, because the thing I do want to add in here too is, and I think this is being recognized a lot more now, is that food allergy patients and families, they're not a one size fits all, right? So every family out there affects them in different ways, in unique ways. And again, I think that's where those touch points really matter. The families can really have the opportunity to tell you, hey, you know, little Joey just wants to go to a birthday party. That's what's important to them. Then you can speak to them of, okay, this is how that slit treatment will sort of enable that. Or, you know, this is what's happening at their daycare. And so we just want some reassurance. Right. And so I also think that that's a great opportunity to talk specifically about that patient's experience. And then again, making sure that the expectations sort of line up. It may be that someone comes in and says, oh, I just want them to eat a peanut butter sandwich. And then, you know, then we got to back up and say, I'm not sure. There's a small subset of kids that might get there, but most won't. But just level setting but then personalizing it. I think really being able to sort of speak to, like, for your situation and what you're looking for, this is what we can expect. And again, it's hard to get that through, you know, a bunch of informational pieces of paper. I think you really got to have those conversations to get there.
1,000,000%. The goals, setting the goals. Mm-hmm. What is your goal? Is your goal to be bite proof? Meaning if he only ate a little bit, that he wouldn't have a severe reaction? Or is your goal to free eat? And then really having honest discussion and revisiting that throughout the course of therapy, because we might have a little kiddo that we think is going to get to the free eating that is having trouble along the way. And then we might have some older kiddos that surprise us.
That's right.
And so it's so important to be able to have those shared decision-making discussions and really be engaged with our families. And I think that goes across healthcare.
Like, yes, we all for sure. Our
doctors to engage with us and let us know what the best potential treatment plan is for us or for our child, and discuss the options. And I mean, based on the studies that are coming out about sublingual immunotherapy, it's certainly an option. And what fascinates me is the age group here. Mm-hmm. And so we talked about desensitization, remission. We talked about sublingual immunotherapy. One question, though, about that. Describe to me the process of the method is the kiddo holds it under the tongue for 2 minutes, right? And then doesn't eat for a few minutes after that. But a one-year-old holding something under tongue for 2 minutes. So talk me through that. Yep. I asked Drew Bird about this a few months ago at our Louisiana Allergy Conference. He had a great response about it. But I know our listeners would love to, because I know they're thinking, wait, they're 1 year old.
That's right.
How are they holding something? How are you getting them to listen and do what you say for 2 minutes?
Yeah, we just hold their tongue up for them. No, I'm joking. Of course not. So, I mean, we do have, within our studies, we have very, very, very experienced nurse coordinators who walk parents through some tips and tricks, trying to get the kids to sort of sing and things like that, that will try to help this. But the reality is, I think what everyone out there recognizes is that for kids that young, it's quite difficult. And most are probably not holding it for the whole 2 minutes, if not even for several seconds. And so this is an aspect that we are trying to understand more, is how long is the right amount of time? So 2 minutes actually was an arbitrary sort of amount that we had seen from other types of sublingual treatments. So we had started with that. But in this particular case, we know that the kids probably struggle to keep it that long, but the benefits are actually the strongest that we've seen with sublingual. So it suggests that you probably don't need to be that long. Again, what is the sort of magic amount of time is something we definitely want to learn for the next step to be able to give sort of the best advice for families doing this. I will also mention that this is also a place where, there is an opening for new types of sublingual treatment. And so there's been some folks, and we're one of them, that have looked into like, oh, could we do this as a dissolving film? Like they have those breath strips that would melt under your tongue. Could we do that? Or there's a company that's in looking into a dissolving tablet. Could you do probably a choking hazard, but could you do a lozenge? Or, you know, are there other ways that we can sort of do it that might better ensure that it's actually held under the tongue as long as it is? But again, coming back to the question, in this case, we did everything we could to train the patients, the families, how to do it. I think everyone tried their best. And then amazingly, the results turned out really, really, really good. And so we do still have more to understand about exactly what the right exposure is, but, not a reason for us to necessarily not pursue this in the short term, though, based on the results.
And I do want to talk a little bit about the study group, not the most diverse group, but that's unfortunately what we see in research at this time. But talk a little bit about the study group.
Yeah. So what we wanted to do, again, the major focus was really on age. So we wanted to go younger just because from some of the other research we had seen, in particular, there was a study that we had started at Duke and finished at the University of North Carolina called the Devil Study, that looked at these young 9 to 36 month olds, and sure enough found a strong, really, really strong desensitization with oral. And so we wanted to see, is that the same concept for the 1 to 4 year olds? Cause we anticipated that it would be a lot safer. So that was probably the most important thing, but still clinical trials are really difficult. There's still lots of visits to the office, blood draws and this and that. As much as we wanted to expand out and try to have all comers come in, usually it's folks that have the time And so it's going to be mm-hmm. families where someone is either home or just has really flexible work that can bring their mm-hmm. child in. And so it ends up not being a very diverse group at all. So in our case, it's heavy white population and probably more sort of upper middle class. And we know from other data that that's not necessarily who has food allergy. Food allergy is more mm-hmm. distributed. And if anything, sort of non-whites may be more prone. And so definitely a big hole in our research that we're trying to, in the design of future studies, as well as sort of in the clinic, we're trying to understand this as well. And just make sure before we broadly advise this to everybody that, you know, different groups do respond the same. Because we don't want to, that would be one of the worst things we could do is we just sort of generalize this out to everybody and realize that's not the case.
Absolutely. Thanks for talking us through that.
Yeah.
And talking about sort of this particular young age group and the effectiveness of this. Figure 4, specifically B, the month 36 desensitization oral food challenge. The intention to treat group, 75% of kids 1 to 2 who started when they were 1 to 2 had a negative oral food challenge at that time or passed. The per protocol, 100%. Mm-hmm. So talk us through what intent to treat versus per protocol means, and then 100%.
That's right. Yeah. So in our clinical research, I think one of the factors that we're always dealing with is going to be patients who are not able to finish, who drop mm-hmm. out of the study for one reason or another. And what is sort of the right way to count them if they've, again, not done everything? And that's where this concept of intent to treat comes in. And typically the sort of what we would say the safest, most conservative, whatever you want to say, way to approach this is going to be to think that anyone who couldn't finish it would have failed, would have not sort of achieved mm-hmm. what you're looking for. So that's what that intent to treat population means. So that includes all 25 kids that were on treatment, all 25 that are on placebo. And of the ones who dropped out, we counted them as actually failing the food challenge. Now, the reality is, could they have passed? Maybe, maybe not. Again, we don't know that. But just so that we don't overcall the data, we consider them on the negative side of failing. And so that's how we get that. Now, per protocol.
That's a good approach to science.
Right. That's right. Yeah.
We don't want to overcall the data.
That's exactly right. And then for per protocol, what that would be is anyone who actually was able from start to finish to be able to do everything that we had said, which, again, could represent sort of how well or not the treatment works. And so it's sort of showing two sides of the spectrum. On the one hand, probably overly conservative and undercalling. And on the other hand, probably overcalling. But it's important for people that are seeing the data to understand it's probably something in the middle is probably what we're looking at. And
which is tremendous.
Yep.
So little drops of peanut, tiny, tiny amounts, most of which was done at home, has permitted these very young children who are not of the age to say, excuse me, I am not allowed
That's
to
right.
have peanut, who cannot protect themselves, who cannot say, oh, this is making my mouth feel funny very well, right? So like a very vulnerable population is my point of kiddos with peanut allergy. 100% of them who were per protocol, 75% intent to treat. I mean, this is amazing.
Yes.
Now that, again, for our listeners, that means that when they went through the study and they got to the point of the study of being on the on SLIT for 36 months, they did that full whopping dose ingestion challenge, they didn't react. And so in real practice, some people will do that next step that you guys did, Dr. Kim, the let's look for remission. So let's stop treatment, have them very much avoid for 1 month, 3 months, 6 months, whatever. But a lot of people in practice would say, okay, we don't want to figure out if you're in remission because our goal is to either get you bite proof or to free eat. And so what do we need to do now to, mm-hmm. to continue this? Because as of right now, you're definitely bite proof, mm-hmm. right? Like, and that gives families just so much relief.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I love seeing our families come through our practice and just the look on their faces when they're seeing their kiddos like eat a whopping spoon of peanut butter mm-hmm. when such a small amount sent them to the ER last year.
Yep.
I mean, this is pretty amazing.
Yeah, obviously I'm biased, but I'm very, very excited by this as well. And I think just a couple points that you mentioned, one of them is the age factor. So in particular, mm-hmm. that 1 to 2 year old group, we had a good number of those kids and they seem to do really well. And this really lines up with recent data that's come out of, first of all, that impact paper for oral immunotherapy I mentioned also suggests that younger, even within the 1 to 4, the younger was better. But there's also recent data that's coming out of the LEAP study. So that the whole study that looked at giving peanut early to prevent peanut allergy. And even in that study, they looked at 4 to 11 month old, but they're easily seeing the 4 to 5 month olds did better than the 5 to 6 and 6 to 7 and so on. And so there definitely seems to be something with your immune system that is just, it's just more willing to be treated and more able to change if you can get in there early. And so it's great to see that our data supports that in our group. I do want to add one more piece though, because I want to be so excited with the numbers, as you said, the 100% and all, but clearly it's a small study. So in our case, it was painful because we did all those patients came to us in Southwestern. So it was a lot for us, but 50 kids is 50 kids. And so if we had 1,000 or 10,000 kids, would we have those same numbers? Again, probably not, but it's going to be good. I mean, the numbers wouldn't be way off from this. And so we do think that this has the potential to help a lot of kids that are out there.
The other important point was that none of the kids in the placebo group outgrew mm-hmm. their peanut allergy.
That's right.
Which is also not necessarily consistent with what we see. Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, we're not seeing 50% of kids. I'm not seeing 50% of kids. The studies are not seeing 50% of kids outgrow their peanut allergy, but you know, we hedge it 20 to 30%.
Sure.
And that's an important discussion when we're saying, you know, do we want to embark on oral immunotherapy right now or sublingual immunotherapy, or is there a potential of them outgrowing it? Do you want to comment? That's really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. So I mean,
really allergic kids.
Really allergic kids. But here's a moment that I do just want to call out the families that participated. I mean, my gosh, like the sacrifices, that these families give for not only for their own kids, but for all families out there with food allergy it's so important because, I mean, there were families that spent 3 years on a placebo to help us to try to understand this, of does this work or not? And the reason we needed that long placebo is what you mentioned. We needed to make sure, is this treatment or are the kids naturally outgrowing it? And so in this study, we clearly saw no one outgrew it during the same time period. So we can pretty confidently say that the majority of what we saw was from the treatment. Now, for those same families, again, there's no way ethically we can leave them out in the cold. And so we had a separate protocol afterwards to be able to give them the treatment that they, had willingly sacrificed. But it's just so important that none of this happens without the families. Again, some naysayers may say, well, they're just trying to get early access. I mean, no. Of course they like that, but these families are absolutely dedicated to the field and making sure that, whatever sacrifice they put in is going to help not only their kid, but all these other families out there. So, I mean, again, can't say thank you enough to them.
Food allergy families are amazing.
They are.
What are some ways that they can get involved in research?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's one of them is to participate, of course. Another is to spread the word. So another could just be that, again, they've heard of some studies, participated in some studies, and be able to share sort of their experiences. Another is to support studies. So, again, we're always looking for groups like FAIR or the NIH and stuff to support studies. But, again, if there may be opportunities to sort of give as well to help with that. Mm-hmm. But I think in all those different ways, but if anything, probably the most sort of way that most families can help is just to continue to bring this positive attention to food allergy. Make sure that the awareness is there that, food allergy is real. There's lots and lots and lots of families. And unfortunately, the number keeps going up. But families that have this, and we really need something that will help our kids, just go back to normal. I mean, I think, cause in every other way, they're normal, but the everyday sort of burden that comes with this, the anxiety, the changes, the effects on quality of life, they're real. And so I think that's probably the number one way that they can help.
I love it. Thank you so much for joining us. What sort of last words would you have for the food allergy mom, dad, who's hearing this? Maybe they have a little kiddo or maybe they have a teenager. What's some of your encouragement to our food allergy families listening?
Yeah. So you mentioned earlier that, I mean, not that we ever want anyone to have a food allergy, but now is a really good time because there is so much hope. We have oral immunotherapy available in many clinics. Our data suggests sublingual could be an option as well. There's studies on this patch medicine, the epicutaneous and biological medicine. And so there are options available now. There are options coming in the near future, and then there are options coming further out than that. And so I think just, you know, again, there's plenty of hope out there at this point. For the families, what I would say is, you know, take your time and understand sort of what those options are, and understand that if the right option may be there now, but it may not be, because food allergy is individual to each family. And so just to hear mm-hmm. those out, and, you know, maybe that next one coming down the road is the right one for you all as well. And so, you know, again, just we're in a good place now, and there's plenty of hope coming.
I love it. Dr. Kim, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for the invitation. This is great.